Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hello, this is April reading the Midland Reporter Telegram for Saturday, June 25, 2020. Presidential Visit. Trump to visit Double Eagle Rig in Midland by Stuart Doreen. Esther Rain at HearstMP.com. President Donald Trump is making a trip to the Permian Basin next week, and it will include a visit to Double Eagle Energy in Midland, according to the White House. During the visit, the president will tour an oil rig and deliver remarks. The White House provided information to the Reporter Telegram that the president is expected to discuss reducing regulation, streamlining the permitting of projects, and incentivizing private investment in energy infrastructure that has helped make the United States a dominant energy power. The president saw the pain caused in the energy industry by the price collapse and demand shock. That energy industry is now contributing to the nation's economic recovery, and the president will continue to support the industry as it rebuilds, according to the statement. Vice President Mike Pence made a trip to Midland in April 2019 and also traveled to a rig site. The White House said Friday the president understands the unnecessary constraints on our energy production, from aging infrastructure to burdensome permitting and regulatory overreach, which ultimately limits job growth and increases costs for Americans' hardworking families. The energy produced in the Permian Basin is vital to restoring the economy by providing affordable, reliable energy for American families and businesses, the release stated. The president's deregulatory and streamlining actions helped make the United States the world's leading oil and natural gas producer, and the president remains committed to American energy dominance. The White House also stated that a result of the president's economic policies, including tax cuts and aggressive deregulatory agenda, is the expansion of manufacturing, energy production, investing in new capital and technology, and creating jobs. Trump's trip to the Permian Basin will include a fundraiser in Odessa. The president is scheduled to appear at an event that is being called a Permian Basin special event with Donald J. Trump, President of the United States, according to the invitation from the Trump-Pence Victory Committee. Activities during the fundraiser range from a $2,800 a plate luncheon to a $100,000 a seat round table. This will be the president's 16th visit to Texas during his administration, according to the White House. Coming Monday, more on Trump's visit to Midland and Odessa coming in Monday's edition. Obituary. Former MC President David Daniel dies, from staff reports. Former Midland College President David E. Daniel died Thursday in Midland after an extended illness. He was 83. Daniel was the college's third president and served from 1991 to 2008. Under his leadership, the college saw a 50% increase in enrollment, a $41.8 million bond pass with 70% approval, and the creation of a baccalaureate degree, according to a press release from the college. David Daniel gave 17 years of service to Midland College and the Midland community, President Steve Thomas said in a statement. He garnered tremendous community support for Midland College and established MC as a national leader among community colleges. I'm privileged to continue to lead MC in its tradition of excellence. U.S. Representative Mike Conaway said in a statement that Midland College and the greater Midland community has lost a staunch advocate. Professionally, David will be remembered for the 17 years he dedicated to establishing Midland College as one of the premier community colleges in the nation while weaving the school into the fabric of our community. Personally, David's friendship and sense of humor will continue on in those who knew and loved him, he said. Suzanne and I send our deepest condolences to Dee Dee and all of David's family and friends. He will be missed. Daniel's other accomplishments include establishing the Midland College Advanced Technology Center, which provides state-of-the-art education and training in technical applications, health sciences entry-level professions, safety training, and workforce skills to high school students, college students, and employees of Permian Basin businesses. Establishing the Cogdell Learning Center, serving South and East Midland. Acquiring the Petroleum Professional Development Center in downtown Midland. developing the M.C. Williams Regional Technical Training Center in Fort Stockton, which later became the college's only branch campus, creating the Davidson Distinguished Lecture Series and the Phyllis and Bob Cowan Performing Arts Series, expanding the footprint of the main campus to include the Jackie Brown Dining Hall, the Dorothy and Todd Aaron Medical Science Building, the Leona G. and John E. Fox Science Building, the F. Murray Hall Academic Building, three residence halls, a new maintenance facility, and the Dolly Neal Chapel. I am proud of MC's place among other community colleges, the development of which has helped to keep this nation at the top of civilization as we know it. People often say to me, "We're so proud of our college." That sense of ownership means everything, Daniel said before he retired from Midland College in August 2008. Daniel was also state and national leader in community colleges. He was chair, 1991 through 1992, of the American Association of Community Colleges, the highest elected office among America's community colleges. He was a member of the AACC board from 1988 to 1993, and in 2005, Daniel was chosen by the AACC trustees as the outstanding chief executive officer for the Western region. His service to Texas higher education includes serving as president of the Texas Association of Community Colleges and as a member of the Texas Council of Workforce and Economic Competitiveness. In 2012, Midland College named the Men's Residence Hall the Daniel Residence Hall in honor of the former president and to commemorate his dedication and 17-year leadership of the college. Energy. Oil prices remain steady above $41, by Mela McEwen. M. McEwen at MRT.com. Crude prices traded in a narrow band this week, but managed to post their third positive week out of the last four. West Texas Intermediate on the New York Mercantile Exchange added 22 cents Friday to close at $41.29 a barrel, up from Monday's close of $40.81 a barrel, as prices held on to much of Tuesday's $1.15 jump. The posted price ended the week at $37.75 a barrel. Natural gas prices also had a positive week with four consecutive days of gains, including a 10-cent leap Thursday to $1.785 per MCF. Prices added another 2 cents Friday to end the week at $1.808 per MCF. Rising demand, a slow recovery in domestic output, and OPEC Plus relaxing production cuts will likely result in a minimal change to commodity prices this year, Ed Longenecker, president of the Texas Independent Producers and Royalty Owners Association, told the Reporter-Telegram by email. Phil Flynn, senior analyst at Price Futures Group in Chicago and author of the Daily Energy Report, wrote Friday that although tensions between the U.S. and China are heating up, so is the manufacturing and service sector data across Europe, as are record runs at Chinese oil refineries. Flynn wrote that oil and crude products pricing had weakened amid new COVID-19 cases and the growing tension between the U.S. and China, but stronger economic data is providing support to oil prices. He said the oil market can look beyond the U.S.-China tension because European Union and Chinese economic data clearly show the global economy is recovering. The Eurozone Flash Purchasing Managers indexes grew faster than forecast in July, according to MarketWatch. The Eurozone manufacturing PMI rose to 51.1 from 47.4 in June, and the services PMI rose to 55.1 from 48.3 in June, as the composite PMI of 54.8, a 25-month high, topped expectations of a 51.1 reading. We also saw the UK market services PMI come in above expectations, surging to 56.6, well above the 51.1 expected and deep in expansion territory. Wrote Flynn, "This data suggests that the recent increase in oil price has not just been based on speculation, but solid evidence of demand. The tightening supply situation in Europe that has driven Brent has shown an incredible V-shaped recovery. While we have a long way to go and there are fears that COVID will reappear, it appears that the demand growth and economies are finding a lot of ways to work around and work with the COVID curse. It also suggests that the oil market's recent price resiliency is justified, and despite a big crude build in the U.S., it is still on a path to tightening global oil supply." He added, "Hannah Gonzalo and a storm to be named later will no doubt mess up oil imports and exports in the coming weeks." Energy. Rig count begins to stabilize. Nation's tally stands at 251. By Mel McEwen. M. McEwen at MRT.com. The rig count is showing signs of stability, even as it recorded its 20th weekly decline. Baker Hughes said Friday the U.S. rig count dropped 2 to 251 for the week, setting a 12th consecutive record low since the oil field services firm began keeping a rig count in 1940. The rig count is down 695 rigs, or 73%, from a year ago, when there were 946 rigs at work across the country. Global demand will continue to rebound through the rest of this year, with a more significant increase expected in 2021. Ed Longenecker, president of the Texas Independent Producers and Royalty Owners Association, told the Reporter-Telegram by email. With improving market conditions, we should see a modest uptick in rig count and exploration activity from the more efficient West Texas operators in the coming months. In addition to some producers continuing to bring shut-in production back online. For the first time since mid-March, the number of rigs drilling for oil is up, rising one rig to 181. That's 595 rigs fewer than the 776 that were drilling for oil a year ago. The number of rigs drilling for natural gas dropped 3 to 68, the lowest dating back to 1987, Reuters reported. In another positive sign, the Permian Basin, where more than half of the nation's oil rigs are active, rose 2 to 126 this week. Still, that's 317 rigs below the 443 that were active last year. Texas dropped one rig to 103, 351 rigs fewer than the 454 reported a year ago. New Mexico was the only producing state to report a gain during the week, adding one rig for a second consecutive week for a total of 51. Eddy County, New Mexico, remains the most active in the Permian with 29 rigs, unchanged from the previous week. Lee County, New Mexico, followed with 22 rigs, up from 21 last week. Midland and Loving counties each reported 13 rigs this week, with Midland dropping one rig and Loving County dropping two rigs. Martin County added one rig for 12, and Reeves County posted the largest increase in the Permian, adding three rigs for 11 at work within county lines. City. 67 new cases bring total virus cases to 1,805, from staff reports. The number of coronavirus cases the Midland Health Department currently is investigating, 67, is the second lowest number reported this week. This brings the total number of Midland County cases to 1,805. The Health Department reported Friday that 853 cases have recovered, up from 808 on Thursday. This month's total confirmed number of cases stands at 1,104. There were 772 of cases before the July 4 three-day weekend. Also on Friday, the city reported the deaths of two Midland County women who were being treated out of town. Coronavirus cases. Monday, 135. Tuesday, 82. Wednesday, 52. Thursday, 82. Friday, 67. This week, 418. This month, 1,104, total during pandemic, 1,805, total tests, 9,520. Midland County COVID-19 at a glance for July 24. Gender, male, 871, female, 934. Age range, 0 to 19, 199, 20 to 29, 469, 30 to 39, 405, 40 to 49, 267, 50 to 59, 196, 60 to 69, 147, 70 to 79, 74, 80 plus, 48. Patient status, recovered, 853, home isolation, 826, hospital, 37, under investigation, 40, unable to locate, refused, 12, nursing rehab, 4, died, 33. Source of exposure, community transmission, 869. Contact to a known case, 656. Travel-related, 224. Under investigation, 45. Unable to locate, refused, 11. Source, Midland Health Department. Ector County active cases down to 984 from 1,142. One death reported. By J.C. Lewis. J.C.Lewis at HurstMP.com. The Ector County Health Department reported that the county has 984 active cases as of Friday, down from 1,142 active cases on Wednesday, a decrease of 158 in Ector County. Medical Center Hospital reported another Ector County resident has died from coronavirus. MCH reported its 29th death was a 45-year-old man who died Thursday, according to a press release. He had been admitted to the hospital from home and had pre-existing conditions. Stress levels for staff at MCH have been a roller coaster this week. MCHS CEO and President Russell Tippin said, "Starting out with some good numbers and having fewer deaths this week," he said, "that makes everybody feel better. Then towards the end of the week, we saw a bump. So it has been a roller coaster ride." Odessa Mayor David Turner again encouraged everyone to wear masks, but didn't say the city has given any mask citations. Coronavirus stats. Medical Center Hospital. 51 patients in-house, 36 patients on isolation floors, 14 patients in CCU with 8 on ventilators, 1 patient in labor and delivery department. Patient list includes 5 from Siena Nursing and Rehabilitation, 5 from Andrews, 3 from Fort Stockton, 1 from Stanton, 1 from Alpine, and 1 from Pecos. Source, MCH. Odessa Regional Medical Center. 16 patients in-house with 8 on ventilators. 1 patient from the Courtyard Assisted Living and 1 from Reeves County. ORMC had 4 discharges and 2 admissions in last 24 hours. 1,636 total tested, 308 positive cases, 1,310 negative cases, 17 pending cases. Source, ORMC. Ector County, 984 active cases, 1,800 recovered cases, 17.4% positivity rate, 2,819 total cases, 1,344 negative results, 571 pending tests, 35 deaths. Source, Ector County Health Department.
City. Total number of virus deaths is at 35, from staff reports. Midland County, the City of Midland and Midland Health confirmed on Saturday Midland County's 34th and 35th COVID-19-related deaths. The 34th patient was a man in his 60s who was being treated at Midland Memorial Hospital. He died Friday. The man was an employee of Midland Health, according to a press release from the hospital. No other details will be released at the request of his family. The 35th patient was a man in his 80s who was being treated at MMH. He died Saturday. These two deaths bring the total to 6 Midland County residents who have died from coronavirus in the last week. The death of a 7th resident was confirmed on Friday. The patient died earlier in the month outside of Midland.
Midland PD investigating deaths of 2 men, from staff reports. The Midland Police Department is investigating the deaths of 2 Midland men in separate incidents, according to the city spokeswoman. Man found shot. When officers responded to a shots fired call on Wednesday evening, they found a man, later identified as 51-year-old Christopher Bruckner, had been shot. A man at the scene was taken into custody for questioning. Bruckner died at the scene, according to a press release. Several witnesses were interviewed. No charges have been filed at this time. The investigation is ongoing. Officers responded at about 5 p.m. Wednesday at the 3900 block of Tumbleweed Trail. Man found in street. A 37-year-old Midland man died Thursday night after he was found lying bloody in the street, according to a second press release. Charlie Dan Clark was found lying in the street in the 4700 block of Laura Drive, covered in blood and unresponsive, according to the release. He was transported to Midland Memorial Hospital, where he died. A woman arrived on scene and told officers what had occurred. She was taken into custody and transported to the Midland Police Department for further questioning. A 6-year-old child was present with the woman when the incident occurred. The child was transported to the Children's Advocacy Center for an interview, according to the release. After interviews with the woman and the child were completed, they were released. Charges have not been filed at this time. The investigation is ongoing. Obituaries. Vicki Crawford. Vicki Ann Crawford passed away on July 11, 2020, after a short illness. Vicki was born on August 7, 1956, to Ralph and Annetta Arnett and was married to Carlton Crawford. She was preceded in death by her parents, husband, and brother Carrie. She is survived by her brothers, Alan, Kevin, Eric, and Gary and her sister Bonnie. Vicky was a kind-hearted person who always saw the best in people and forgave easily. She was willing to give her time and efforts to helping others and was always there for her family and friends. Vicky was quick to smile and tried to always see the bright side of things. Vicky loved arts and crafts and spending time with people. Services have been scheduled for 10 a.m. on August 1, 2020 at West Kentucky Baptist Church, 1507 West Kentucky Avenue in Midland. Death Notices. Janet Ollie Hamilton. Janet Ollie Hamilton, 54, of Midland, passed away Friday, July 24, 2020 in Midland, Texas. Janet was born on February 10, 1966, to Judith and Joseph Hamilton. Services will be held at a later date. Arrangements by American Heritage Cemetery Funeral Home Crematory. Luis Rodriguez. Luis Rodriguez, 82, of Big Lake, passed away July 22, 2020. A viewing will be Sunday, July 26, 2020, from 1 p.m. to 9 p.m., with a rosary starting at 7 p.m. at Llewellyn Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home Chapel. Funeral Mass will be Monday, July 27, 2020, at 10 a.m. at Our Lady of Guadalupe Parish and Shrine. He is survived by his wife, Lucia V. Rodriguez, 4 sons, Juan V. Rodriguez, Juan Javier Rodriguez, Jose Alfredo Rodriguez, and Santo Angel Rodriguez, 8 daughters, Maria Teresa Rodriguez, Maria Virginia Ramirez, Rosa Clara Rodriguez, Augustina Rodriguez, Susana Rodriguez, Maria Regina Rodriguez, Bibiana Patricia Rodriguez, and Fidencia Guadalupe Aguilar. 37 grandchildren and numerous great-grandchildren, nephews, nieces, and cousins. Stephen B. Sisson. Stephen B. Sisson, 31, passed away July 19, 2020 in Midland, Texas. Stephen was born June 28, 1989 to Joanna and Neil Sisson in Midland, Texas. No services are scheduled at this time. Arrangements by American Heritage Cemetery Funeral Home Crematory.
Hi, this is Linda. I'm reading the Odessa American for Saturday, July 25th, 2020. Section A. Lawmakers ask for health facility visitations, by Ruth Campbell. Dozens of state lawmakers, including Representative Brooks Landgraf, Republican Odessa, have signed a letter to Interim Executive Commissioner, Health and Human Services, Phil Wilson, requesting that he allow people to visit loved ones in health facilities, nursing homes, and assisted living facilities. But while nursing homes understand the desire to reconnect with loved ones, at least one has concerns. I've heard from so many constituents who have family members who are in nursing homes or assisted living centers or group homes. So many of the residents in these facilities are just struggling so much with the isolation, particularly those who just can't understand the concept of the lockdown. We're just hearing so many stories where the isolation is leading to depression and is having significant negative impacts on their health and well-being, Landgraf said in a phone interview Friday. We understand why there's a no visitation policy, but it just seems like it's overly broad, and we want to find a way for these residents who desperately need this interaction with loved ones to have it in a safe way, Landgraf added. He said the Health and Human Services has jurisdiction over nursing homes and assisted living centers, so we are asking the Health and Human Services Commission to implement these safeguards that would allow for safe visitation by loved ones to their family members in these nursing homes and assisted living centers. The letter says, in part, with proper guidelines, these facilities could resume visits in a safe and socially distant environment. Additionally, we would ask that the primary family caregiver be recognized as an essential part of the resident's care team. The presence of a primary family caregiver is to be able to pick up on subtle changes to calm the unspoken anxiety that results from their missing presence and to continue to encourage their loved one to walk, eat, and engage in social activity that is vital to their care, it details. Further, suggestions for allowing a primary family caregiver could include requiring the same expectations as a paid professional caregiver, including infection control training, responsible behavior outside of the community, limiting their exposure, following all guidelines in regard to infection control, and wearing face masks. The family caregiver shows documentation of a COVID-19 negative test. The facility offers a designated visiting area with regulated scheduled times and 15 minutes in between visits to allow for cleaning and disinfecting. The facility limits the total number of visits in a day to maintain a low traffic flow and only allow one designated family caregiver as the essential caregiver. If at any time these guidelines are not adhered to, the family member would be asked to leave the community. We will not stand to let these Texans fall through the cracks. Their life is important. The fact is, this disease is not what's hurting them. It's the harmful restrictions we have in place that are. Time is of the essence, and it truly is a matter of life and death, the letter states. Landgraf said several lawmakers, including himself, have been informally asking for something along these lines for quite some time. I know that I have personally since May, but what we're trying to do now in a broad statewide coalition is asking for these reasonable accommodations to be made. But unfortunately, I don't have an idea for the timeline, but it does need to happen as quickly as possible because the health and well-being of nursing home residents is at stake here, he said. He noted that those who live in nursing homes, assisted living facilities, and group homes are inherently members of a vulnerable population group, and the last thing that any of us want is an outbreak in a facility. We've unfortunately seen all too many of those, both here in West Texas and throughout the state. So we don't want that to happen. But we do believe following this five-step plan can allow for safe visitation while also protecting against outbreaks. And to me, it's a better way to balance those two interests. But absolutely, isolation can have a tremendously negative impact on the health and well-being of these residents. Landgraf was asked if there was an outbreak, if loved ones would be able to see them through the window and talk to their visitor on the phone. That would continue to be promoted, he said. There would also be in this proposal a limit on the number of visits in a day, just so that you're maintaining low traffic flow. And also, if at any time the guidelines are not adhered to, then a family member would be immediately asked to leave that facility. He said HHSC has a surge response team for outbreaks, and he contends that the number of outbreaks at these type of facilities has declined over the past couple of weeks. Focused Post-Acute Care Partners has seen a number of COVID-19 cases, and many points in the company's statement requested by the Odessa American Friday reflect what was in the lawmaker's letter. Focused Post-Acute Care Partners understands that connecting with family members is incredibly important, and our team members have remained diligent in ensuring ongoing communication exchanges via telephone, text, email, and Skype or Facebook, a statement from Focused Care founder Mark McKenzie detailed. There is certainly a nexus between health and well-being and being physically close to loved ones for all of us, and certainly our seniors, who we have been protecting and caring for, need that. We are supportive of a controlled and carefully regulated easing of restrictions on visitation by a designated family member to a long-term care community. Any plan to open the door to visitation must be carefully considered with all precautions in place to maintain the safety and care of our residents and team members that we have worked around the clock for the last 5 months to achieve, a goal to which there is not yet light at the end of the tunnel, as Texas COVID-19 cases continue to escalate. Any visitation would not include exposure to an active COVID wing or quarantine area within the building, the statement said. Focused care would require that visiting family members meet the same standards the professional workforce must meet. This can be done without officially designating family members as essential staff, as it is critical we control traffic in the buildings. This would require weekly testing and proof of test results by the family member before entering the building, McKenzie said in the statement. Focused care set requirements in place early on designed to limit who enters our communities for the safety of our residents and those who care for them. We limited team members who work in multiple skilled nursing communities to working consistently in one location. It was necessary to implement the same policy with traveling contractual therapists when our on-site testing revealed a positive outcome of one therapist who had been to three different communities. We are challenged still with state agency surveyors who go to several skilled nursing facilities to conduct evaluations and still aren't required to test when we have requested they do so, the statement said. Any plan moving forward must take into account all of these issues, which are based on life and death matters. Focused Care is prepared to consider a plan that best protects everyone and allows for physical contact between loved ones and residents that will certainly bring joy to all of us, McKenzie's statement concluded. Census Bureau to offer help with call-in assistance by Michael Bauer. Every 10 years, counties and communities try to make sure that everyone gets counted in the census. The same applies to Midland and Odessa. This weekend, the U.S. Census Bureau will look to help those who have yet to turn in their forms in the area by hosting call-in questionnaire assistance events in Midland and Odessa as part of Faith Communities Census Weekend of Action. Saturday, the call-in questionnaire assistance will be from 9 to 11 a.m. for Midland residents and noon to 3 p.m. for Odessa residents. It's just to educate the public, which may have questions on why or how to fill out the census, to encourage our little sector that we impact with faith-based communities to make sure that they fill out their census questions either by mail or online. And if they don't have either, we can give them instructions on how to participate, said Administrative Assistant at True Light Christian Fellowship, Carla Smith. Call-in numbers are 432-999-1848 or 432-999-0970, where a census response representative will be available to assist residents who have not responded to the 2020 census questionnaire or have questions concerning their forms. While Smith believes that they are undercounted in Midland, she's hopeful that they can calm some concerns about other parts of the area being undercounted. We have targeted areas in every county that have been undercounted and underrepresented, Smith said. Hopefully this can allay any fears that people have about filling out the census. There are numerous imperative reasons why filling out the census is important, which include funding for projects and highways, congressional representation, and more. States and communities are entitled to federal funding for different entities, Smith said. Road repairs, and it's based on census numbers. And when you're underrepresented by 40,000 people, you lose out on millions of dollars that you are entitled to. If you don't have the numbers, you don't have the money. As far as the reasons for people who don't turn in their census forms, Smith thinks it's because some residents don't feel like they make a difference. It's like voting where they think their vote doesn't count or they don't think their census will impact much, Smith said. I think the 2020 census group has done a good job of putting together advertising to show why everyone makes a difference. Every number increases our chances of receiving the funding that we need for our community. If we're underrepresented, we're underfunded for education, underfunded for emergency services, and underfunded for roads and everything that people use. ECHD to update 5 days a week by Michael Merlot. The Ector County Health Department, ECHD, detailed Friday that they will start reporting county COVID-19 data next week by 5:30 p.m. Monday through Friday on its website. An Ector County Health Department press release detailed that it has become impossible to deliver case numbers by the 3 p.m. deadline, and that is because of the uptick in testing by multiple entities. The Friday release detailed incorrect information regarding county testing locations, and later Ector County Judge Debbie Hayes confirmed that Saturday's testing would be from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. at the South Ector County Volunteer Fire Department. The ECHD website detailed Friday that out of 2,819 positive cases of COVID-19 in the county, 1,900 cases are confirmed positives, 919 are probable cases, and 984 cases are listed as active. The website showed that 69 COVID-19 patients are currently hospitalized, with 31 being in an ICU and 16 on ventilators. 35 Ector County residents have reportedly died from COVID-19-related complications. 1,800 have recovered, and 571 tests are pending results. Mayor David Turner said during Friday's virtual hospital briefing that some people are getting delayed test results from the city mobile tests because of lab returns, while City Public Information Officer Devin Sanchez reported in an email that tests are coming back faster than expected, and if anyone is having issues getting their results, it could be a problem with the contact information. Medical Center Hospital President and CEO Russell Tippin said the stress level of the week was like a roller coaster. Just starting out with some good numbers, we had fewer deaths this week, which makes everybody feel better. And then here towards the end of the week, we've kind of seen a bit of a bump, he said, adding that while the staff is stressed, they are hopeful, and the talk of a vaccine is helping people's moods. MCH reported that a 45-year-old man died Thursday night from COVID-19-related complications and that he had pre-existing conditions. They reported that he was an Ector County resident who was transferred to the hospital from home. He was reportedly the 29th MCH patient to die from COVID-19-related complications. A Friday MCH press release detailed that out of 986 positive COVID-19 cases, 51 patients are in the hospital. 18 are on the 7th isolation floor, and 18 are on the 8th isolation floor. 14 patients are in the critical care unit, and 8 of them are on ventilators. 1 patient is on the labor and delivery floor. The patients in the hospital include 5 from Siena Nursing and Rehabilitation, 5 from Andrews, 3 from Fort Stockton, 1 from Stanton, 1 from Alpine, and 1 from Pecos. No persons under investigation are in the hospital, and 171 tests are pending. Odessa Regional Medical Center Chief Medical Officer Dr. Rohith Saravanan reported that out of 1,636 tests, 308 people have tested positive, 1,310 have tested negative, and 17 tests are pending. 16 COVID-19 patients are in the hospital, and 8 are on ventilators, he said. The patients in the hospital include 1 from Courtyard Assisted Living, and 1 from Reeves County. The ECHD website can be located at tinyurl.com/Y2CJQSVQ. In other COVID-19 news, a press release from Governor Greg Abbott's press office detailed that the Texas Military Department, TMD, and Abbott announced a new joint task force to strengthen the COVID-19 response in the state. More than 1,200 service members have come together from the Texas National Guard and the active and reserve components of the U.S. Army, U.S. Navy, and U.S. Air Force to support hospitals in Houston, San Antonio, Del Rio, and the Rio Grande Valley, the release stated. Man charged with sexually assaulting woman. An Odessa Police Department probable cause affidavit detailed a 31-year-old man sexually assaulted a 34-year-old woman multiple times on the same day. Raul Lerma Jr. was charged with sexual assault, family violence, a second-degree felony, and failure to identify by giving false or fictitious information, a Class B misdemeanor. OPD officers were dispatched July 21st to the Walmart located on Loop 338 on the west side of Odessa. A 34-year-old woman reported she was a victim of a sexual assault. The woman reportedly told officers she was sexually assaulted by Lerma and stated she went to Walmart to call the police to avoid conflict. The woman stated Lerma sexually assaulted her on two occasions at 4 a.m. and 10 a.m. July 21st. Lerma reportedly fled the city limits after sending text messages to the woman in which he claimed he was going to kill himself in relation to the allegations of indecency with a child. Lerma was later located and also charged with failure to identify by giving false or fictitious information. Lerma agreed to speak with officers where he verbally admitted to engaging in sex with the woman three times, the affidavit stated. He confirmed the woman didn't verbally consent to the sex. Lerma was arrested, charged, and transported to the Ector County Law Enforcement Center. He had two bonds totaling $25,500 and posted bail July 22nd, jail records show. Death notices for Saturday, July 25th. Enrique Almanz, Live Oak. Enrique Almanz, 94, of Odessa, died Tuesday, July 21st in Live Oak. Graveside services will be held at 1 p.m. Monday, July 27th in the Los Angeles Gardens section of Ector County Cemetery. Arrangements are by Acres West Funeral Chapel of Odessa. Janet Ollie Hamilton. Janet Ollie Hamilton, 54, of Midland, died Friday, July 24th. No services have been scheduled. Arrangements are by American Heritage Cemetery Funeral Home Crematory of Midland.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading the Midland Reporter Telegram for Sunday, July 26th, 2020. Section A. Commentary. Name of Robert E. Lee High School doesn't pass the why test, doesn't reflect community's values. A commentary by Rick Davis, president of the MISD Board of Trustees. I, along with my fellow school board trustees, have been listening to our community's differing views on whether we should continue to have a high school and a freshman school named after Robert E. Lee, the commander of the Confederate States Army during the American Civil War. As you would expect, Midlanders have not been shy about making their views known about this sensitive topic through emails, letters, and telephone and in-person conversations. And no matter what side of this issue a person communicating with me has been on, virtually everyone has encouraged us to publicly address this issue. I agree. I recently read an article by Jim Dennison entitled, "What Does the Bible Say About Removing Statutes?" that I found to be extremely helpful and consistent with my views. Although it addresses statues and monuments, I believe it also has application to the naming of a school, especially because, generally speaking, students do not have a choice as to which public school they attend. Dennison, who formerly was pastor of First Baptist Church in Midland, suggests there are three categories of monuments. One category is where the purpose is to mark the location of an historical event, such as a historical marker noting where a battle took place. Another category is where the purpose is to honor people in spite of their sins for some particular positive aspect of their service. A third category has a purpose of honoring people for service that does not warrant honoring. The first two are legitimate reasons for erecting and keeping a monument. The third is not. Dennison suggests that a way to determine a monument's particular category is to ask, what was its purpose? What was it intended to honor? In short, why was it erected? He suggests this why test can help provide clarity as to whether it is appropriate for it to continue. I agree. For example, no one suggests that the reason why memorials or statues were erected for Thomas Jefferson was to honor his status as a slave owner. Instead, the reasons for erecting them were to honor him for his contributions to the founding of our country and for being the author of the inspiring words of the Declaration of Independence. It is with the above criteria in mind that I believe the naming of Robert E. Lee High School was in 1960, in the midst of the Civil Rights Movement, 6 years after the U.S. Supreme Court's decision prohibiting segregated schools, and about 6 years before Midland desegregated its high schools. I feel it fails the why test. Any doubt about why it was named after General Lee is removed when you add the fact that the Rebels was chosen as the school's mascot, depicted by Johnny Reb, and the Confederate battle flag became its first de facto spirit flag. When I read the Declaration of Causes, which impelled the state of Texas to secede, which can be found on the Texas State Library and Archives website, it seemed clear to me what a bad idea it was, especially in 1960, to name a high school honoring the general who led soldiers fighting for such causes. Changing the name would not be an effort to erase history. Instead, remembering history is what should cause us to change the name of the school that was so named in a misguided attempt to honor such history at that particular time in our history. And finally, there is evidence that Lee himself would have opposed the naming of a school after him, given his public disapproval of erecting monuments commemorating the Confederacy. He correctly recognized then, more than a century ago, they would likely be sources of future civil strife. But this decision is about much more than simply righting a past wrong concerning the naming of a high school. It is also about moving forward to reflect the character of our remarkable community. I believe we should be ill-served by continuing to debate whether we should continue to have a high school and freshman school honoring Lee. The rancor that comes from that serves no productive purpose and oftentimes results in unfounded and inaccurate personal attacks by both sides as to a person's motives or beliefs. Those attacks are especially troubling because they do not represent our core values. Midland is truly a special place with extraordinary, caring, and generous people. For all these reasons, I believe it is time to change the name and form a citizens' committee to make recommendations as to what the name should be. I also believe the members of that committee should include persons who were either past Lee graduates or parents of Lee graduates. I think current students should also be included. I think it is important to ask all members to draw upon their memories and experiences and focus on what has made the school special so that the new name can reflect it going forward. In the meantime, please know that we and everyone at MISD will remain focused on addressing the educational challenges that coronavirus pandemic is presenting to our students, parents, teachers, and staff, while continuing to seek to improve the educational environment, resources, and academic outcomes for all students. This is a challenging time, and I'd like to thank all those who have generously contributed and are still contributing their time and support to MISD. We are also grateful for all the encouraging words and prayers. Thank you. Trustees to Vote on Name Change by Stuart Doreen, S-D-O-R-E-E-N, at HearstMP.com. Members of the Midland ISD Board will vote Monday night on whether to rename Robert E. Lee High School and Robert E. Lee Freshman High School. The item is listed on the agenda for the virtual board meeting, which is slated for 5:30 p.m. Residents who want to view the meeting can go to the district's website, MidlandISD.net, for instructions on how to view the live feed and how to comment on any of the items on the board agenda. The agenda packet item on Lehigh states that members of the local community have expressed interest in renaming the campuses named for the Confederate general. An executive summary indicates an online petition started by Courtney Ratliff has collected more than 10,000 signatures and states that the prominent alumni have come out against the current name. Eric Winston, former president of the NFL Players Association, and Michael Williams, a former railroad commissioner and former Texas commissioner of the Texas Education Agency, are two graduates who have told the Reporter-Telegram of their opposition to the Robert E. Lee High School name. The executive summary also stated there are people in the community who have expressed their opposition to a name change. Both sides have urged the board to publicly address the issue. In an opinion article in today's edition, Board President Rick Davis said the name of the high schools do not reflect our community's values. I believe it is time to change the name and form a citizens committee to make recommendations as to what the new name should be. Midland ISD regulations indicate that board approval is required in all matters pertaining to individual schools, including the naming of school buildings and campuses and adopted nicknames and mascots. Robert E. Lee High School in Midland opened in 1961. It has been stated that the school was named based on the recommendation of students of Midland High in 1960. Both the naming of the school and opening of the school took place before desegregation in Midland ISD. Robert E. Lee High Schools have opened in the late 1950s and early 1960s, including campuses in Tyler, San Antonio, and Houston. Houston ISD board members voted in 2016 to change Robert E. Lee High School to Margaret Long Wisdom High School. Northeast Independent School District board members in San Antonio voted in 2017 to change Robert E. Lee High School to Lee High School, as in Legacy of Education Excellence. Last week, Tyler ISD board members voted to change the names of their two high schools, including Robert E. Lee. Of all the Lee High Schools, even before name changes, the only community that kept the rebel mascot was in Midland. A commentary by Stuart Doreen, S-D-O-R-E-E-N, at HurstNP.com. School Board President Shows Leadership. The op-ed by Midland ISD Board President Rick Davis in today's Reporter-Telegram is a signature piece of leadership from a man who has worked quietly and diligently to make Midland ISD a better school district. There probably hasn't been an elected official under more scrutiny over the past 12 to 24 months than Davis, who more than a decade ago signed up for service on the board where political aspirations have been known to die. Davis, though, hasn't just gone through the motions as a board member and board president. He hasn't treated his time as someone who sought the office to build a resume. He has worked to convince a community dominated by private schools and other educational alternatives that its public school district can be better. Davis led the board's effort to work with the Texas Education Agency on a Lone Star governance plan that was meant to create better outcomes for students. He has lobbied to anyone that would listen about a school funding system that, for the last decade, has taken hundreds of millions of dollars out of the Midland community and passed it on elsewhere. During his time on the board, starting teacher pay will have increased by at least 40%. And while some efforts haven't gone as well as he and others would have hoped, you can look at the recent happenings and say for certain he had the district's best interest at heart. Davis has challenged the community twice since 2016 to think about raising taxes for a better district, once for operations and another time for facilities. In both cases, he was trying to bring Midland ISD to a playing field similar to other districts across the state. And in both cases, they were discussions worth having. About the Robert E. Lee High School name, Davis has been challenged to address the situation. I have written that our community just needed to move on one way or another. It appears the Midland ISD board is on the verge of making that happen. And without a doubt, Davis's op-ed today lays the foundation for that to happen in a way that the item will be addressed and our community can move on. It won't make Davis the most popular man in Midland, but real leadership isn't about being loved. It's about being right. And as the president of an elected school board, he was right to say this is where we are to go from here. It is also about moving forward to reflect the character of our remarkable community. Our remarkable community will only be as good as its leadership. And in Davis's op-ed, that leadership and character were on display. And Midlanders wanting a decision about the future of Robert E. Lee High School will get one.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.